You are Locked On Warriors, your daily Golden State Warriors podcast. I'm Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to bring you your team every day. And this is a good example of that because today your team was not on television. And so had a, let's call it a narrow pool of people to that were at the game of my media friends. And fortunately, Tim Bontemps of the Washington Post was gracious enough to give me a little bit of his time. And so we talked about what was a pretty interesting game in some ways. It was unusual in terms of the turnovers and all that, and we'll get into the substance of it. But we talked for about a half an hour on what we took away from the experience of a game that wasn't televised. So it feels like we have a little bit of a challenge here, or an obligation if you want to call it that, because we get to talk about a game that almost nobody got to see because it wasn't on TV.
Iron Rise wasn't on TV. That's interesting.
Yeah, so
I guess I should have realized that, but I didn't. I guess
that's one of the big reasons I was there is because I when it wasn't going to be on TV, then I decided I wanted to be there to share the experience with the listeners. And there are a lot of different ways to take this game. It was weird in a lot of different ways, just in terms of the Warriors turning the ball over a lot early, but still having some really strong performances. And so instead of me dictating at the very beginning, what was your biggest takeaway from this game?
I think in the macro, it reinforced what we saw Tuesday and what we saw Saturday, which is that, you know, I mean, a lot of times the conventional wisdom winds up being wrong, right? But I think with the Warriors, I think the conventional wisdom is going to prove correct, which is that if you're going to beat this team, it's going to be by pounding them inside and slowing the game down and keeping them from getting out in transition. Because we saw tonight what we saw on Tuesday, which is that whenever the Warriors get a chance to get out on the break, they're going to be dominant because they have all of these guys that can get out and make threes and wreak havoc on the opposition. And, you know, when did they struggle tonight? When DeMarcus Cousins, one of the best big men in the league, was pounding them inside. And, you know, and on Saturday against the Raptors in Vancouver, they struggled when, you know, Jared Sullinger and Jonas Valanciunas were pounding them on the boards. And I think that when you look at kind of the data we have so far, that's when this team is going to struggle. When they have opposition that can bang with them inside and wear them down and slow the game down and keep them from running. The question is going to be, can anybody who tries to play that way do it for long enough that they're not going to get annihilated when the Warriors go small? And that is the question that remains to be answered. But I think we do know what this team's vulnerabilities are, and they are, I think, what we kind of expected they would be.
Yeah, that's certainly fair. And the other angle, which is analogous to that, that I used to start out my piece, which will eventually go up on The Athletic, is that something that carried over from this game to last Saturday is that the best way to beat the Warriors is with their help. This is a team that is really good when they're on, and while Sacramento ended up not capitalizing on everything the Warriors gave them, it's pretty amazing. The Warriors had, I believe, was 8 turnovers in the first quarter, and Sacramento had 0 fast break points. So that can be a little bit of it, and most of those, I believe, were live ball turnovers. I think they had 6 steals in that first quarter. So that is the type of way that is part of what the Warriors can kind of do to themselves. And we saw that a little bit last year, too, with that loss they had to Boston at Oracle. I remember steals playing a meaningful part of that game as well.
Yeah, I mean that's the other thing, right? This team is going to be capable of throwing the ball around. Durant's a guy who can rack up turnovers. Same with Draymond, same with Steph. You know, those are all guys that when you handle the ball a lot and try to make fancy plays, you tend to have the propensity to maybe turn it over a little bit. And, you know, if the Warriors, you know, the Warriors could certainly stub their toe doing that just as they could by getting mauled on the glass. And I think, you know, if you look at their losses this year, you know, not that it's different from many teams, but if you look at their losses this year, probably most of them are going to come from a combination of teams either, you know, really beating them up on the glass and getting a bunch of second chance points, or, you know, the Warriors just kind of throwing a game away by either missing a ton of shots or, you know, throwing the ball around and giving it to the opposition.
One interesting thing that struck me when I was reading Anthony Slater's piece after the game, and he did a nice job of articulating some of the issues at the center position, but I hadn't really thought about it too hard and realized that of the teams that you would probably put in the group of the biggest threats to the Warriors in terms of playoff series, none of them really have a dominant offensive big man. And you can talk about how there might be a correlation there that those teams aren't good, like, you know, that the teams that have those guys for whatever reason aren't as talented overall. But that is a little bit of a bullet that they might be dodging at some point this year. But there are talented guys. I mean, Favors and a series of other guys can play well inside Pau Gasol. But they're like DeMarcus and maybe Karl Anthony Towns aren't really on those real contending teams.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked a lot about Minnesota and Karl Towns, but I think a year or two from now, you know, they're going to be a huge problem for this Warriors team, because you look at a guy like Towns, just like you saw Cousins tonight, and the Warriors don't have anybody that can match up with a guy like that. And whether they go big or small, because Draymond can't guard a guy like that, and, you know, Zaza Pachulia is, I think, a decent player. And I think people are kind of jumping to conclusions a bit on him, because I think, you know, people have to remember, like, he probably has a bigger adjustment to make in terms of figuring out all the defensive calls and everything the Warriors want him to do than even a guy like Durant does. You know, it's just, he has a lot to, just a lot to adjust to and a lot to figure out. So I'm not really surprised that it's taken him a minute to catch up, but even if Zaza's fully integrated into things, you know, he's not going to be able to slow down a guy like Cousins or Towns. And I do think that, you know, when the Cavs, you know, the Cavs have Tristan Thompson, who's a mauler inside, but not really a, you know, a really effective scorer. You know, I do think that is one thing that's going to work in their favor. And it would be interesting to see how, say, a team like the Spurs matched up with them if they played some LaMarcus at the five and Kawhi at the four and let LaMarcus kind of go to town inside. Maybe, you know, maybe that's a situation where, you know, they could run into a little trouble. But I think San Antonio's guard play is probably, you know, they probably don't have the guard play to go with that to really give the Warriors trouble either. So, yeah, I do think that, you know, that is kind of the luxury of having Kevin Durant, right? Like, if you do have a weakness, you have so much power everywhere else that it kind of makes up for it.
Yeah, I mean, you have enough strength that no team is going to be perfect. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast, is that
right.
No team is going to do that. So you want to make sure that your strengths are there. And talking about Durant ties in with something that, along your early theme of, you know, that it confirmed both games, is that there was this idea that I think a lot of us shared that we don't know who's going to get the open looks that are generated by the Warriors' offense, but somebody will. And this was the first game where it wasn't Clay, it was Durant that got more of them. And it was shocking, like it was every once in a while in the Clippers game when Curry got open, that there were a couple times where Durant was just wide open. And that's something that's different, and he was nailing those shots comfortably from, you know, 26, 27 feet.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about this team, like I was saying before, like when they get in any kind of even, you know, semi-fast break situations, it's you know, when it was just Steph and Clay, you could find those guys and you could, you know, get a body on them and slow them down a little bit, right? But when you look at this Warrior team now and you have Steph, Clay, and Durant on the break, sometimes with them running on the break with Draymond bringing the ball up, it's just impossible to find that many guys in transition. And you saw, you know, any time tonight when they got in one of those situations and ran out, one of those guys wound up being wide open. And, you know, one time it was Steph, a couple times it was Clay, and a lot of times, to your point, it was Durant. And that's probably going to change from night to night. But, you know, all those guys are such good shooters that if they get, you know, even a partially open look, a lot of times you're going to think it's going to go in. And they were a lot of the time getting wide open looks tonight. And It wasn't even really anything Sacramento was doing wrong. It was just that, you know, those guys are just so, they screw up a defense so much when they're all out there that it's kind of impossible to keep track of everybody.
And that was a huge difference with the Warriors in that early part of the game between them in transition versus in the half court, was that Sacramento did a great job of playing the passing lanes and predicting where passes were going to go in the half court. But you really can't do that in transition because there are more options and there are fewer defenders. And so they did a nice job of kind of figuring out what the Warriors were going to do. But in those kind of circumstances, there's not much you can do.
Yeah, I mean, when you have that many options, it's mostly just try to stay with them as long as possible and then hope they miss. I mean, you know, that's kind of the beauty of this team, where they're just going to overwhelm just about every opponent with just the sheer number of options they have. I mean, it's really, you know, you saw it kind of in its perfect form on Tuesday, where, you know, all those guys get going. It's going to be like, you know, like an avalanche going down the mountain. And it's just, there's not going to be a way for a team to slow them down if they all get going at the same time.
And while the final outcome isn't that important in a preseason game, the biggest difference in this was that the Warriors' end-of-the-bench guys, really, I would say the guys that are at the end of their act, like the guys that are actually going to make the team, were better than those guys for Sacramento. Both McCaw and Ian Clark looked pretty good tonight, and then they got kind of enough overall to really make it work.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought Ian Clark up. I mean, there's been a lot of Pat McCaw talk led by our pal Ethan Strauss, lately. And McCaw is an interesting prospect, and he's got a chance to carve out a job for himself in the league. But I think you saw today why Ian Clark is going to start the season as the ninth guy in the rotation, which really, you knew eight guys already. You had the five starters, and then Livingston, Iguodala, and David West. And, Ian Clark has from the start been the ninth guy. And if you look at this Warriors team, all you need that guy to do is be able to knock down open threes. If he can play a little defense, great. If he can handle the ball a little bit, great. But mainly you just want a guy that when the ball gets swung to him and he's wide open because he's going to be, that he can knock down shots. And Clark went, I think, 4 for 7 on threes tonight. He made a few threes the other night, too. And I think, he's shown he's capable of knocking down those open shots. And as long as he does that, I think he's going to have that spot locked down for the foreseeable future.
The analog in terms of the starting lineup is Klay Thompson's role, is that while Klay can do a whole lot more than Clark, being a poor man's Klay is more than enough to make the offense work on the second unit, and Clark is capable of handling the ball and adding a little bit more than just that bare minimum, but doing that is notable for this team, especially if they're going to play Livingston at the one, because Livingston is an immensely talented player, but he doesn't add that kind of spacing. Defenses handle him really differently, and so getting that from the two is very important. And while McCaw could be talented defensively, I think that he will get there, and his shot, it's getting there. He's not as good a shooter as Clark, but that's not a surprise. And so even if he was, like, if you want to think about it in terms of, like, overall impact, and I'm not saying this is true, even if Clark were a little bit worse than McCaw, and I don't think he is, you might still want to play him just because he fits what they're looking for better in that role.
Right. And the other thing is, too, unless a rookie is a pretty high draft pick, a lot of the time, most coaches are going to go with the veteran first anyway. And it's going to take the veteran's either going to have to really cough it up, or the rookie's going to have to be so good that they go, well, we got to play the rookie now. I think the safe way to look at this situation is that, Ian Clark is going to probably be that guy this year. He's probably going to shoot 40% from three or close, and then he'll go get a fat contract this summer from somebody. And then their ideal scenario is that next year, as a second-year player, Pat McCaw is ready to be a full-time rotation guy and could step into that spot and kind of do that job. I think if everything works perfectly for the Warriors, that's exactly how it'll play out.
And something they tried today, which felt like it'll be part of the end game for this season, is in some of the less important times, they played McCaw and Clark together with another point guard. For a little bit it was Livingston, for a little bit it was Curry, and you don't really want to do that in a time that's important, like where the game is on the line, because you're just really small at those positions, unless it's a really thin three that somebody can guard. But if you're just gobbling up minutes, that's a nice way to do it. And that's a big part of the reason why, at this moment, McCaw makes a lot of sense to be on the active roster, as opposed to being maybe in the D League and playing more minutes, is that he can be a part of this overall team, even if he's not the ninth guy in the rotation.
Yeah, and I think he's the tenth guy. I think he's going to get some minutes, regardless. He's shown a propensity to get his hands on the ball on defense, and he can knock down a shot. Like you said, he's not a bad shooter. I think when you look at how the Warriors play, I think he's going to be the tenth guy. And, if Steve Kerr does play 10 guys, I could see McCaw sticking in the rotation right from the start. But, normally coaches are going to play 9 guys, and I think you've seen, I know people couldn't watch this game tonight, but it wasn't really a different rotation than the first two. You've basically seen Kerr play 9 guys, and then he kind of throws McCaw in there for a couple minutes. And, I think that's probably how it'll continue. And, McCaw's definitely already shown he can do some stuff, and, whenever they rest guys, he's going to get minutes. Like, I think he's definitely going to have a chance to get significant minutes right away. And if he gets playing like he did, like he has his first couple of preseason games, he'll keep himself in the mix right from the start.
Speaking of in the mix, I'm struggling to grapple with the idea of how to resolve the center stuff outside of the top guys. So we'll count Draymond just for the heck of it, but he's not going to discuss it. Zaza and West. And so really that's the guys on guaranteed deals are McAdoo and Varejao. And then JaVale is competing with them. Theoretically, they could keep all three. I'm guessing they won't. But the challenge for McGee, to frame it this way, is that he has to be, I guess you could use the phrase you used for McCaw, is that he has to be undeniable because the other two guys have some entrenched advantages on him.
Yeah, I actually think the battle for the 15th spot on the roster isn't really between any of those three guys. It's between JaVale McGee and Elliot Williams.
I agree.
Elliot Williams, who is currently out after undergoing knee surgery in the offseason. And I think Elliot Williams is going to make the team. I think the play that kind of summed up where JaVale is at right now is there was a fast break. I want to say it was in the third quarter, but Draymond Green came down and threw the ball towards the rim for JaVale. And JaVale kind of struggled to get up and get it over the rim. He caught it and he kind of fumbled it and laid it in eventually. But he's had some injuries and he clearly just doesn't have the same level of insane athleticism that he used to. And, you know, I just think when you look at this Warriors team, you've got, you know, Draymond, Zaza Pachulia, David West, McAdoo, Varejao, and Kevon Looney, all guys that could theoretically play the five. Do you really need a seventh guy that can do that? I just don't see it. Whereas Elliot Williams got a big guarantee from the Warriors as a partial guarantee guy coming into camp. JaVale got no money. And Elliot Williams is another wing, and they frankly need depth on the wings. I mean, if they have, you know, McCaw, you know, we just talked about McCaw and Clark a lot, and those guys are playing well, but they don't really have anybody behind them. And, you know, they don't really have a third point guard. So, you know, having a guy like Elliot Williams on the team balances out the roster a little better than if you have JaVale there. So, you know, maybe his knee situation doesn't improve fast enough and they decide not to do it. But to me, and the other thing too, is Steve Kerr's a guy that really values locker room chemistry and having harmony in the locker room. And I mean, JaVale's just such an, you know, he's got enough of a history as a bit of an interesting character that it's just hard for me to see that, you know, that's the direction these guys would wind up going in the end.
I agree with it on the merits. And what is a challenge for them is that if there were, like, kind of the idea of having a firm guy in that 15th spot could be problematic for them just because you don't know where the need is going to arise. Like, when rosters can only be 15 deep and active can only be 13, you're going to need something at some point. You know, somebody's going to have an injury or something like that. And part of the problem of having, you know, having somebody locked in that spot, whether it's Williams or McGee, is that, you know, you don't know that you're going to get exactly what you need from it because, you know, if let's say a point guard gets hurt, then you're going to need somebody like that. If a three or a four gets hurt, then you're going to need somebody there because the Warriors are, as much as we focus on the, you know, the guard spots, they're really, they're two guys that really play the three for them. And so the challenge for any of them, if you were thinking about it in the kind of the way that I do sometimes of like, you know, maybe it'd be better to keep it open. But as a realistic matter, teams don't do it that way. They do the best with what they can.
Right. And I think, you know, what you could see, I think, is if there's a situation like that where maybe you get to February and there are some buyout guys, then, you know, whether they keep JaVale or Elliot Williams or, you know, they let McAdoo go, like there are some guys towards the back end of the roster that, you know, if they decide there's a guy out there they really want to go get, they could just let one of those guys go. I mean, the Warriors, their salary is lower, and they're not, if I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure they're not really near the luxury tax. So it's not like if they let one of those guys go, it's going to cost them a ton of money. It's just, you know, they just have to let one of them go and then, you know, go pay the remainder on whatever the guy's salary be for the season. So, that, you know, you're right that, you know, there isn't a lot of depth on the wing, especially, you know, especially when you consider some of the injury history that a guy like Andre Iguodala has had. But, you know, that's also something that they'll be able to address if they have to as the season progresses.
And if you're talking about backup threes, you can fudge it for a couple games if you have to with somebody who's smaller. Like, that's not the biggest thing in the world. And if Kevon Looney.
Right, they could play Sean Livingston it. They could play Sean Livingston at small forward.
Yeah, they could do a couple different things. Like, you know, it's not the biggest deal. Like, that's part of the challenge with those perimeter spots is sometimes teams get too rigid about it. They go, oh, you need to have somebody. And to his credit, Rick Carlisle, somebody who's done that really differently, is like, well, if you need more ball handling in your backups, why not play two point guards? Nobody has the personnel to exploit that. You know, it's not like anybody's sitting there going, oh, we have this beast. We have this beast of a backup two that's just going to brutalize these guys. I mean, that's just the way the NBA works is there aren't that many awesome players. And the spots were usually where teams are excessively deep aren't really those spots necessarily. You know, that's just, I mean, the Warriors are an extreme rarity to have two starting caliber small forwards. And the Warriors don't have to play
in between. Right, exactly. Yes, exactly. Luckily for them. But yeah, between Iguodala and Durant and Sean Livingston and Klay Thompson, I mean, they've got a lot of guys who are long, who can guard threes in a pinch. So, you know, they can fudge it however they have to make it work.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Anything else that struck you about this game?
We talked about it a little bit, but I know this is the Locked On Warriors podcast, but I came out of that game optimistic about the Kings. I think that, you know, that's a team that, you know, has, you know, I think they've done a nice job of getting some guys that are going to compete and grind for them. Guys like Aaron Aflalo and Matt Barnes, you know, just some, you know, some vets, give them a little more toughness. And, you know, I think, you know, George Karl is a Hall of Fame coach, in my opinion, but, you know, that was obviously a toxic situation last year. And I think, you know, having Dave Yeager, who's a good coach in there, hopefully can give them a little bit of stability. And I think that team's got a chance to be pretty good.
I agree with you. And one of the huge differences between them this year and last year is that they still have a lot of young guys that probably aren't going to contribute much. But this year, they don't need them to. You know, this isn't a spot where they have just Ben McLemore at the two. They have McLemore and Aflalo. Their forward spots are deep. Omri Caspi didn't even play in this game, and sure they could have used him, but Tolliver, they played two centers a lot. Rudy Gay, you know, like Matt Barnes, they did a solid enough job there. And so when you can play capable NBA guys for 48 minutes or close to it, that really helps. I'm still a little dubious about their shot creation outside of, you know, Boogie and Lawson. I thought actually looked pretty good tonight. Like, it's going to be,
yeah,
it might be
Ty
hard.
Ty Lawson looked like he'd lost a lot of weight and looked like a guy who, you know, was trying to, who'd realized that his time might be running out and needed to try to make sure he stayed in the league. I don't know about you. I thought he looked like a different person than he did physically last year. And, you know, that was something that he had to do if he wanted to try to stick in the league. That really stood out to me. Now that we know about Darren Collison getting 8 games, getting suspended for 8 games to start the year, you know, that's going to be a huge opportunity for Ty Lawson, because if he can come out for those games and prove that he can still play, I mean, heck, he might even get a chance to just start for the Kings, and, you know, that could really allow him to get another contract next summer and kind of get paid again. And that would be, you know, given where his kind of career has gone in the last 12 months, that'd be pretty huge for him.
And to bring it back to the Warriors, one of the storylines of this game, and I think it was true of some of the other teams they faced, Toronto is another example of this, that there are a lot of NBA caliber guys in the league now. I mean, we saw teams a couple of years ago, thinking about that Knicks squad that was there, the Lakers a couple of times the last few years, that just were rolling out lineups and at different moments that had two or three guys who probably shouldn't be in the league, or at least shouldn't be playing rotation minutes. And overall, there are fewer blatant gaps in the league. I think some of that is longevity and training and all that, and that is something that hurts the Warriors to a degree, because they're top heavy enough, and they're like, they could exploit those things just like any team that's better than those squads can, and that will make it, you know, that'll give them a little bit less throughway, because unlike today where the Kings just played guys that probably aren't going to make their team or aren't going to play in those last minutes, you know, they're, for the most part, they're going to face teams more like what Sacramento had in their top 10 guys tonight.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I think if you look around the NBA, there's not a lot of teams that, look to your point, have, you know, just empty holes in their rotation. You know, and I think that, you know, I do think that it, you know, it is a good sign of health for the league going forward. And, you know, I think that, you know, I think that that, you know, I, to be honest, what it says to me is that what I would like is for the NBA to go from 30 teams to 32 and get a team finally back in Seattle and find another city, because I think, you know, it's hard for me to look at the empirical evidence. And, you know, I'm not somebody who thinks the league should go past 32 teams. But, you know, if you look around at the NBA, it's clear that there's enough guys to go around. And I think the fact that, you know, by all accounts, there's going to be some form of two-way contracts in the next CBA, not to get way in the weeds. But I think, you know, doing stuff like that is going to only allow for there to be even more guys that are able to turn into NBA players over time. And that, you know, that's just going to lead to even more depth and the ability to spread that talent out even further. So, you know, I just think it's, you know, I think you're 100% right. And I think it's another sign of the NBA just being in a really good place overall right now. And it's as a basketball fan, it's pretty nice to see.
Well, and as the league gets more money just through revenue and everything like that, their lower end contracts get more competitive compared to the rest of it. And the more jobs you create, if you make it go to 32 teams, then, you know, that creates some good jobs that are out there, and players that are maybe on the fringe between deciding where they're going to go might not ever leave for Europe in the first place. And that can help maybe find some of these guys. Though, I mean, we'll see what happens with Malcolm Delaney. You know, like, he could be an interesting example of an American guy who went overseas and really found himself and then came back. Like, we could see more of that as well over time. And the other idea, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on this, and you and I have talked about this at length before, is that if they combined expanding the number of teams and decreasing the number of games each team plays, that would actually be another way to increase depth, because you could theoretically play starters a higher proportion of the game.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, as I think I've told you before, I'm sure, you know, I think anybody who wants there to be less games, I just think is fighting a battle.
It is not happening. It is not happening.
And it's never, it's a fun intellectual exercise. That's just what it's going to be, an intellectual exercise.
Yeah, I firmly agree with that. And it frustrates me periodically, but at a certain point you can't cry over spilt milk. But yeah, and at the same time,
it means you can see teams like the Warriors play 82 games instead of 60 or whatever number people want it to be. So I think that's a good thing.
And now the Warriors get, you know, they get a week off, which Coach Kerr seemed pretty enthused about, considering they can take a day off and then really do some practices, because that is a weird dynamic in the NBA, is that, you know, they had media day and then they started games pretty quickly thereafter. So to maybe get a little bit of reps in and see what they have and then really get down to brass tacks and do some practicing, because once the season starts, people lose track of this. Teams don't practice very much.
No, and especially not a veteran team like this. And coaches hate the preseason. It's just a, for the most part, a waste of time. And they would much rather have, you know, maybe four games, maybe not even that many games, and just practice every day for a month. You know, that if it was up to a coach, that's the way they would prepare for a season, not playing seven or eight preseason games and going to San Jose and going to Vancouver and going to, you know, wherever else. They'd rather have as many days in the gym practicing as possible. So, you know, I know, you know, Steve was definitely fired up today about the idea of being able to go spend a week in the gym and just, you know, kind of have another mini training camp. And, you know, they're going to go to San Diego for a few days too after that and work out there. So, you know, I think that for him, it's definitely going to be better than having, you know, three games in, you know, 5 or 6 days like they have the last few days.
And something that it's easy even for media members, but even more so for fans, just because of the level of access, is that from what I know, coaches can learn more in terms of evaluating players in that practice time. You know, it's not while we are limited in terms of what we can learn from practices because we don't get to see it, and fans get to see usually even less. It is, you know, it's a very important time for them. And so you get this weird thing where it's like, oh yeah, they're getting a big help, but we're not getting much info out of it. So for selfish reasons, it kind of sucks, but
yeah,
it does help them a lot.
I was just going to say, basically all the decisions you see about guys making teams and different things in preseason, very rarely, if ever, does that come from what guys do on the court in a preseason game. It's way more important how a guy is practicing and how he's fitting in that way than anything these guys do in the games, because, you know, a lot of the stuff in these games is just kind of helter-skelter, and, you know, it's just everybody knows nobody's really taking it that seriously. So it's good to watch the preseason games to see stuff like, you know, for instance, with the Warriors, how they've pretty clearly set up how they're going to go into the season rotation-wise. Like, that stuff is interesting to get out of. But when you're talking about, like, is JaVale McGee going to make the team, or is so-and-so going to make the team, or that kind of stuff, a lot of that comes down to practice habits more than it does what they do on the court in the preseason game.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I think that's a good way to end it. But thank you so much for taking the time.
Anytime, Danny. Happy to do it, man.
Thanks again to Tim Bontemps for taking the time. He's an absolute champ for coming on and recording this at about 1 a.m. because that was really when we kind of got back and got settled after everything, because it takes a little while after a game like this. And I really do appreciate that. And you can read him at the Washington Post, and you can follow him on Twitter at Tim Bontemps. That's TimBontemps. And since this is coming out on Friday morning, that means it is the final Locked On Warriors podcast of the week. It was a really fun one for me, talking with Adam Woritson after the Clippers game, then doing the Reddit mailbag, which came out yesterday, and going into some other topics throughout the week. And so trying to make it a mix of really topical stuff and things that you can listen to over more time. And that is the hope. And I also really want to thank everybody for the support. Now we're in the top 100 on iTunes for sports charts, which is fantastic. And new podcasts do get a bump. That's just the way it works, but it doesn't happen without your support. And I really do appreciate that. And if you have any feedback, positive, negative, indifferent, you can reach out to me, Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux on Twitter, or DannyLaRueNBA@gmail.com. I read everything, respond to what I can. And you can also follow the show, Locked On Dubs on Twitter, Locked On Warriors on Facebook, or LockedOnWarriors@gmail.com, whatever works for you. And it's been a great run so far. It will continue to be that. I was really happy. I think it was yesterday we got our 50,000th listen. That was great. Broke 60,000 today. So that's just amazing. And having Tim on, I'm sure, will help with that. And listenership is not the end-all be-all of everything. It is not how I define success or a show being good or anything like that. But it does help. And in terms of the idea of having advertisers and eventually making this something that can add to my profile financially, which selfishly but also unselfishly would be great, those kind of things do matter. So I really do appreciate you taking the time. Also, since it's Friday, another good reminder to check out Locked On 49ers and Locked On Raiders for your NFL needs. I mean, the Niners had that rough game today, but still a good, in some ways that makes it a better time to listen. And the Thursday games are certainly strange, but good to have that in the repertoire. And for Locked On Raiders, hopefully a better result coming from that. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.